and shod in enormous swarthy footwear. What is it about high-mindedness and big black shoes? If Tootsies peek out the ends of little white Joan and David pumps, does this cause toenail painting? Does toenail painting lead to tanning parlors? After tanning parlors, what? These women could wind up at a Jimmy Buffett concert if they aren't careful. Or maybe big black shoes are in the bylaws of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, so bugs can see your feet coming and avoid a horrible death by squashing. I was about to ask why a crowd of Ernest Gals and Doc Martens was flying to provincial Mexico when I saw the laminated credentials hanging from their necks. Of course, they were pestering the Mexicans, too. They were international election observers. So, upon inspection, were lots of other people on the plane, and not just women void of makeup. There were also men void of makeup. There were, in fact, observers of every ilk, from human rights organizations, labor unions, foreign policy think tanks, and democracy-boosting institutes funded by both Democrats and Republicans. They wore big black clogs, big black sneakers, big black hush puppies, and big black wingtips. Some 600 electoral visitors, as the Mexican government called them, had crossed the border to make sure our friendly neighbor to the south wasn't larding the ballot boxes and boiling the vote count. We get the same sort of thing in the United States. You remember, during the Clinton-Bush race, how all those Saudi Arabians were hanging around our polling places, making sure our national referendum was on the up and up, and asking our electoral officials questions such as, "Is every man letting all four of his wives vote?" I admit, we Americans would hate having a bunch of foreign Nosenheimers poking around in our political process, but you can't compare the United States with Mexico. Mexico has one political party that has stolen every election since 1929, while America has two political parties that have stolen every election since 1852. Never mind. Mexico needs us, but Inski's meddling in its plebiscite. We have to midwife self-government, nurse freedom in its cradle, train the toddler liberty to sit upon the pot of universal suffrage because Mexico is an emerging nation. But Mexico was home to the splendid Olmec civilization in 1100 B.C., when O'Rourke's were living in trees, and Mexico was settled by Europeans a full century ahead of what's now the United States. Well, Mexico is an underdeveloped country. Mexico has an annual gross domestic product, $100 billion greater than Sweden's, and its economy is growing faster than our own. Note journalistic prescience about looming Mexican economic collapse. Come on, Mexico is part of the Third World. You can tell because they speak English with an accent and they're darker than we are. And so all kinds of people dripping good intentions were on their way to grace the Mexican national elections of 1994 with their presence, myself included. Although you can't accuse me of high-mindedness, I'm a reporter. What a story this was supposed to be. Mexico's ruling party, the PRI, is famously awful. Its very name, Institutional Revolutionary Party, is a list of disgusting things. The PRI dominates the labor unions, the mass media, and most of Mexico's businesses. What it doesn't control directly, it controls directly anyway by bribery and intimidation. But public anger at the PRI has been growing for years. Mexican citizens are insisting upon open government. This time, the PRI was getting real competition from PAN, the National Action Party, conservative, pro-business, and, actually, almost indistinguishable from the PRI, which has spent the past 6 years privatizing industries and promoting individual enterprise. Plus, the PRI was getting real competition from the PRD, the Democratic Revolutionary Party, liberal, socialistic, and almost indistinguishable from the PRI, which has launched a broad range of anti-poverty and social spending programs. But there was real competition, even if you couldn't exactly tell the competitors apart. And in the middle of this three-way Donnybrook, the PRI presidential candidate, Luis Donaldo Colosio, was assassinated. Which goes to show just how backward is the Mexican attitude toward democracy. Everybody knows that in modern countries you don't shoot presidential candidates. You wait until they're elected. Mexican law enforcement officials seem to have hired Oliver Stone to investigate the killing. Colosio's murder remains unsolved somehow, even though the shooting was videotaped and the gunman was arrested and he confessed. The PRI was forced to come up with a new candidate, Ernesto Zedillo, who has the approximate charisma of Walter Mondale on NyQuil, Just to make things even more interesting, the day NAFTA went into effect, a group of peasant guerrillas wearing ski masks burst out of the jungle and took over 4 towns in Chiapas State, causing the whole world to ask, "Where did they get ski masks? The nearest bunny slope is 2,000 miles away. And don't those things itch? It's 90 degrees out." Yes, the situation was tense and dramatic when we do-gooders arrived in Mexico. Then, nothing happened. The campaign was peaceful. The polling went more or less smoothly. The vote count seemed close to fair, close enough for government work anyway. The guerrillas, who'd been chased into the mountains by the army, stayed up there. And the people of Mexico re-elected the PRI. The PRI is corrupt, stupid, power-mad, antiquated, undemocratic, and Mexicans returned them to power. They did this while all of us earnest big black shoe types were right there caring so deeply about political liberty. Where are the Mexicans getting their lessons in governance? Probably from Americanos. Think of Mexico as Dan Rostenkowski Nation. Note journalistic prescience about looming Rostenkowski electoral defeat. The fact that nothing's happening never stops a real reporter. I hired a translator, whom I'll call Rolando, and Rolando and I went straight to an open-air marketplace to do the Hombre and the Camino interviews, which are the heart and soul of election news coverage the world over. I can't tell you why. We all know what happens when you stop the man in the street and ask him a question about anything other than elections. How do we get to I-95 from the Lincoln Tunnel, for instance? You wind up in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. But during political season, this same randomly chosen schmo is supposed to possess the wisdom of Mary Matlin and James Carville combined. I picked a fabulous-looking Indian woman in full native regalia, her kindly face riven and creased by life's long experiences, and her black eyes sparkling with the ancient sagacity of her Mayan forebears. "Were the elections honest?" I asked. "Was she going to vote? What party did she favor? Which party would win? What changes did she expect from the new government? Would the advent of true democracy propel Mexico at last into the front rank of industrialized nations while increasing its influence on the international diplomatic stage and providing a reliable system of legal safeguards and a comfortable standard of living to its people? Who knows?" she said. The second interview subject, a younger Indian woman in not quite as full native regalia, just giggled. The third, a young man sitting by a pile of melons and fiddling with a comic book, answered, "See?" to every question, until someone in the crowd pointed out that he was too young to vote. Way too young. 12 or something. A man running a stall selling buttons, thread, and sewing needles said, "I hope the election will be fair because we deserve a change." He favored the PRD. A woman leaning on a butcher block next to the severed head of a pig said, "I think the elections will be fair, but I don't know who will win." She favored the PRI. An older woman making sausages out of parts of the pig even less appetizing than its head told Rolando and me, "Only God knows who will win. All I do is pray to God. I don't think to be on the side of a party will save the country. I don't go for any of the parties. I'm for peace." Then she began badgering Rolando. "So who are you for? Who do you think will win?" "Well, that's kind of a private matter," said Rolando. "I mean, isn't this supposed to be a secret ballot?" Peace was mentioned by a number of the interviewees. They were referring to the ski-masked uprising which began only 50 miles from Tuzla. The insurgents call themselves Zapatistas, after Emiliano Zapata, one of the heroes of the Mexican Revolution. Zapata believed in land redistribution. His idea was to redistribute land so that wealthy landowners had a small plot 6 feet deep. The revolution lasted from 1911 to 1920 and killed an estimated 1 out of every 15 Mexicans. So, in Mexico, when they say peace, they aren't talking about disco medallions or Haight-Ashbury finger splints. People were for peace, of course, but all over the market, people were also selling little Zapatista figurines, handmade rag dolls wearing Indian serapes and steamboat springs, style-knit headgear, and carrying tiny carved wooden assault rifles. I talked to a pretty Indian woman standing behind a heap of Zapatista dolls, 6 pesos each. Who was she for? Her small son jumped up and thrilled, "El PRI!" Aside from some pre-Columbian raiment, occasional pig heads and the Zapatista dolls, also Zapatista key rings, and, seriously, Zapatista pen and pencil sets. Tuzla was hopelessly normal. Though this is the capital of one of the most remote and impoverished of Mexico's states, its residents seem to have lost sight of their obligation, when foreign correspondents are on duty, to be foreign. The place looked like the affordable housing sections of Los Angeles, except the streets were clean and the businesses weren't boarded up, burned out, or covered in grates, bars, and sheets of bulletproof plexiglass. Real revolutionaries apparently don't spend much time looting carryouts and beating truck drivers. Tuzla seemed like a long way to go just to describe dull elections when we've got perfectly dull elections of our own at home this fall. Note, even more journalistic prescience. I tried hard to find something unusual and exotic. There was a marimba concert every evening from 7 until 9 in Tuzla's Central Square. Well, they were really big marimbas. In fact, these marimbas were so big it took 3 or 4 guys to play them. The effect was like reading several years of Playboy jazz poll results. Lionel Hampton on the vibes, Lionel Hampton on the vibes, Lionel Hampton on the vibes. Outside town was a large cement building with a sign reading, Instituto Nacional Indigenista, which, considering what Mexico can do to the tummy, but Indigenista turns out to mean indigenous in Spanish, and the institute was the equivalent of our Bureau of Indian Affairs. I gave up and went to the mall. The city had a brand new big one with vaulted ceiling, glassed-in atrium, and peach-colored stucco walls. It possessed such non-third-world touches as handicapped parking and wheelchair access, and was called Galleria, Spanish, also English, German, French, and Japanese, for mall. How remote and impoverished is Chiapas supposed to be if it supports a store devoted solely to Hello Kitty products? The Tuzla Galleria was slightly more fun than an American mall. You could smoke, and the rent-a-cops had guns. The cop hanging around in front of the jewelry store had an M16. And the gigantic modern supermarket, which occupied one end of the complex, employed swarms of 10-year-old bag boys dressed in neat blue uniforms and matching piss-cutter caps. They packed the groceries with fervor, not so much for tips, but because as soon as they filled a customer's shopping cart, they got to shove it down the wheelchair ramp, jump on, and take a high-speed ride into the parking lot. On the night before the elections, there were thousands of people at the mall, panic buying for fear there would be rioting or even guerrilla war in the wake of the ballot. Americans would have been shopping for ammo and Rottweilers. The Mexicans were shopping for food. Mexicans are by no means less violent than Americans, but they are better cooks. Downtown Tuzla was festooned with the highly colored symbols of Mexico's political parties. Plastic banners were strung on wires across the main streets and hung so thickly that I seemed to be in an environmentalist nightmare, a triple canopy petrochemical jungle. Most of the party symbols had been X'd out. A good reporter can learn a lot by observing such details. The X's across the banners of every political party showed that Mexicans were deeply dissatisfied not only with their present government, but with the entire political establishment. The X's also showed an intrinsic orderliness to the Mexican character, because every X had been carefully drawn in trim, straight lines. Interesting, I ruminated to Rolando while I wrote profound conclusions in my notebook, the way nearly every party symbol has been defaced. They're printed that way, said Rolando. That's how you mark your ballot in Mexico, with an X. Oh, I said, erasing things. Perhaps San Cristobal would prove more fruitful. This is the second largest city in Chiapas and was the main target of the Zapatistas, who invaded the town center at 2:30 in the morning on January 1st and held the municipal palace, the radio station, and the principal square for 24 hours. San Cristobal is a 2-hour drive east into the Chiapan highlands. It's 7,500 feet in the air. The highway loops and tangles like tape yanked out of a broken cassette deck. The cornfields rising from the roadside are nearly vertical, the way crops are painted in folk art, so much so that I thought maybe Grandma Moses wasn't a primitivist with no perspective technique. Maybe she was living in Chiapas and painting from life. It's impossible to imagine how the Highland Indians could make a living from these fields. Even if they did manage to grow a crop, it would just roll away and deliver itself to their downhill neighbors. Since the time of the Spanish conquest, the Indians have been treated like dirt. Not that well. Arable land is scarce in Mexico. The Indians have been treated like living manure. They've been ignored or exploited, usually both. It is these impoverished people who form the rank and file of the Zapatistas, though the most vocal leader, who styles himself Subcommandant Marcos, is a pale urban mestizo. "I heard he maybe was a journalist," said Rolando. I expected San Cristobal to be as poor as the Zapatistas, but it wasn't. It was beautiful. Actually, it was cute. There were columnated plazas and teensy streets and Spanish colonial buildings attempting to look formal and Madrid-like, though made of adobe. Old carved doors gave glimpses of green-shaded courtyards and lots of those big terracotta pots with which all Latin countries seemed to be plagued. Every third block held a cathedral, with all surfaces inside and out, covered in the full canonical miniseries cast of angels, saints, lambs, doves, virgins, and baby Jesuses. I was told San Cristobal had so many richly decorated ecclesiastical edifices because of the forced labor levied upon the Indians. Carving a snappy Mary Magdalene was better duty than working in the mines or the perpendicular truck gardens. So every time a church was finished, the Indians would get religious visions and clamor for another church to be built. Nowadays, what the Indians did was sit outside these churches, selling arts and crafts to hippies. San Cristobal was full of hippies. There were way-back hippies growing gray, spreading out under their caftans, and straining the buttons on their embroidered work shirts. There were new-hatched neo-hippies fumbling with the icons of the 60s, wondering whether the peace symbol is supposed to be used mainly as a nose stud or also as a pierced eyebrow ornament. And there were smelly European backpacker hippies, age indeterminate, telling the locals, "Ich bin ein Vegan." The hippies were excited by the Zapatistas. Mexico is, you know, so romantic. Ignored and exploited people under the command of a light-skinned Hispanic who might be a journalist took over a picturesque place full of handicrafts. To put it in American terms, a band of first wives led by Geraldo Rivera invaded Carmel. But in Mexico they play for higher stakes. Witness the jewelry store guard with the automatic weapon, or go to a bullfight. Imagine taking a confused and stupid animal and tormenting it to death for the sake of dramatic entertainment. We'd never do that to cattle in the United States. We use celebrities. In order for the Zapatista revolt to be a successful publicity stunt, Mexico style, blood had to be shed. The Mexican army came in and obligingly killed 250 people, according to the Mexican army, 500 people, according to the local bishop, and 1,000 people, according to all the hippies. Most of the casualties were, naturally, innocent. Guilty people are better motivated to hide. Also, they fire back. When the army retook San Cristobal and the other towns, Indian peasants who had the bad luck to be standing around looking too ignored and exploited got shot. There was a cultural institute, Cum Coffee House, in San Cristobal, run by a very nice American of the Peter, Paul, and Mary generation. He'd come to the Chiapas Mountains to make a new life. "I fought American foreign policy for years," he said. "The Iraq War was the last straw." But he admired the Zapatista rebellion. He may have a good moral point here. I just don't know what it is. Would everything have been okay if the Iraqi army, rather than the Mexican army, had shot the Indians? Should George Bush have bombed Tuzla instead of Baghdad? A hand-lettered sign on the Cultural Institute's bulletin board offered a lecture on the Zapatistas and a tour of sites in San Cristobal where principal events of the rebellion had occurred. The tour consisted of walking over to the main plaza and staring at the municipal palace. There were bullet holes, I was told. "Where?" I asked. "They've been patched." And there was revolutionary graffiti, but the building had been painted. The lecture audience was me, a Canadian college student with very long hair who wanted to be an alternative journalist, and a denim-clad middle-aged woman who ran the Cultural Institute's bookstore and who must have heard all this before. We sat around one of the coffee house tables. Two Indian girls came in and showed some small pieces of embroidery to the middle-aged woman, who cooed extravagantly. "You should get some soap," the woman said to me. "The Maya love soap. If you're going to be out in the remote villages, it makes a perfect little gift." Though I would have been inclined to give it to the backpackers. The two Indian girls retired to the next table and ordered Coca-Colas. The college student had a homemade press card laminated in plastic. "You're a professional," he said. "Does this look convincing?" The lecture was given by a grad student from Mexico City, whom I'll call Juan. Juan was in San Cristobal doing his anthropology thesis on the positive effects of tourism on indigenous peoples. His thesis was that there weren't any. "But what about the money the Indians get from selling, small pieces of embroidery?" I said. "That money only goes to the sellers," said Juan. Therefore, Juan's argument was that people who don't make money from tourism don't make money from tourism. Juan said there were three basic causes of the Zapatista revolt. One was the nation's lumpy distribution of wealth. Juan claimed that, since 1988, Mexico had acquired 24 new billionaires, few of whom, I gathered, were Chiapan Indians. This seemed a bit abstract to me. You might be able to become a thousandaire, exploiting the local impoverished peasantry, but richer pickings are required to make a billion. Even at his most predatory, Michael Milken was not seen peddling junk bonds in Chiapas State. Then there was NAFTA, the Mexican campesino with machete, digging stick, and nothing in the way of a tractor but his wife, now found himself competing directly with American agribusiness and all its federal subsidies, government price supports, and fishy tax breaks. NAFTA was a certificate of death for the indigenous, said Juan. The Zapatistas really should have attacked the U.S. Department of Agriculture, but Washington's a long way, and bargain airfares are hard to get at New Year's. The good news is, between the billionaire problem and the NAFTA problem, we may have found something for Ross Perot to do with his life. The most important cause of the rebellion, however, was land reform, and here one's sympathy for the Indians ran headfirst into the lintel on that low doorway, which is logic. You can redistribute the land in Chiapas in a way that's too fair for Mother Teresa, and everyone still winds up with a bedspread-sized patch on a 45-degree angle. Will the Zapatistas be less angry when they finally get their farms and it's a technical climb with ropes and pittons from the outhouse to the barn? The Zapatistas don't want to impose communism, said Juan. They want to carry on with capitalism, with social justice. They want to get social justice from capitalism? Said the college student, who was trying hard to be a leftist and was deeply shocked. Do they want to become capitalists, or do they want to continue on their communal land with just enough food every year? His tone implied that the latter alternative was a goal to which all mankind might aspire. Juan, sounding a bit disappointed himself, said the Indians wanted to have legal title and private ownership of individual plots. Fortunately for revolution, the Zapatistas wanted lots of other things, too. They have 11 basic demands, said Juan. Suitable roof, adequate food, health, education, work, peace, justice, independence, democracy, freedom, and one other thing that I'm not remembering. Which is a lot to expect from taking over a town square for 24 hours. These are essentially human rights, said the young Canadian, reverently. And he was correct about the human part. It's hard to give democracy to cows. Not enough of them would vote to be hamburgers. I had to drive back to Tuzla that night, through fog banks and thundershowers, past swaying, skidding tractor trailers, and ancient brakeless buses, down the curly, devious plummet of a road, which, in place of guardrails, has little white crosses memorializing those who missed the turns. Supposedly, there are 365 curves between San Cristobal and the state capital. But Rolando said only two of them have names, the monkey's tail, El Rabo de Mono, and the horseshoe, La Herradura. What a waste of nomenclature opportunities. Hair in the soup, El Pelo en la Sopa. Argument with Jesuits, La Disputa con Jesuita. Tongue of my first wife, La Lengua de mi Esposa Primera, and... Now we're fucked. Ay, que fucked! were just a few of the suggestions I made during 2 hours of terrorizing Rolando, myself, and a number of Indian pedestrians who were under the impression that the purpose of a double yellow line is to mark the path for women carrying firewood. I needed to be in Tuzla because the Mexican Federal Electoral Institute, IFE, had screwed up my press credentials royally. I mean, freely electedly. The Rolling Stone staff had spent weeks on the phone, fax, and Federal Express exchanges with the Mexican consulate, making sure my credentials would be waiting for me, which they weren't. But IFE officials in Tuzla assured me the credentials would be sent on the next plane for Mexico City, and the following plane, and the plane after that, on more planes from Mexico City than Tuzla gets. My press credentials were not only not arriving from Mexico City, they were also not arriving from Oaxaca, Veracruz, and Quintana Roo. This made the IF people sad. They were worried about me wandering around without proper identification. So they got out a Polaroid camera and a laminating machine and made me an ID, at least as convincing as the Canadian college students. It said I was a Mexican reporter. I look Mexican the way Steffi Graf does, and the only words I know in Spanish are, "Ay, que fucked." The IFE officials considered this and grew worried anew. "Do you have a press visa?" they asked. I couldn't get a press visa without credentials. "But you can't get credentials without a press visa." Fortunately, Mexico is a country where, though nothing works, everything can be fixed. IFE had an entire bureau of the Mexican Immigration Service in its offices for just such an eventuality. I spent an hour filling out forms in duplicate and handing them to a panel of young women who typed up more forms on large electric typewriters. San Cristobal answered the question, "Where did all the hippies go?" And the Mexican Immigration Service provided a definitive response to the query, "Whatever happened to carbon paper?" When all that was done, IFE got worried a third time. If I had an American passport with a press visa, how could I have press credentials saying I was Mexican? This might confuse the authorities, they said, even though they were the authorities. But I suppose they had a point because they were confused. They said I'd better come back the next day and get those credentials from Mexico City after all. I was a little concerned about credentials myself. The Army had checkpoints all around San Cristobal, and plainclothes police were being sent into the areas formerly held by the Zapatistas. I saw a stake-bed truck full of men in jeans and sports shirts, each carrying an automatic weapon. It looked like the Moody Loaner's outlet store was receiving a wholesale shipment of disgruntled postal workers. So I made my way down the wet, ugly, dark mountain road to Tuzla, rushing to get to the IFE office before it closed. They said they'd thought it over, and the credentials I already had would be fine. Anyway, no matter what kind of official papers you're supposed to have in Mexico, the official to whom you give them always seems completely perplexed, as though he were a traffic cop who'd stopped you for speeding and you'd handed him your college transcript. My Mexican press card and American visa bothered no one, but a soldier at a roadblock was very concerned by my passport. It's valid until the year 2000. The cover page reads, "Date of expiration, 16 August, 00. The soldier thought it had zeroed out. Mexico is confusing. Mexico is confused. Vast complexity mixes with the simple inoperative. Speaking of traffic cops, I blew by one on the Tuzla bypass going 60 in a 30-mile-an-hour zone. "Oh, don't worry," said Rolando. "He's local police. This is a federal highway. Only federal police can bother you here." What is it with Mexico? Why are Mexicans so much in love with authorities' forms while having so little respect for formal authority? "With precaution, every red light is a green," was Rolando's other piece of driving advice. And what does all this have to do with everybody saying mañana all the time? Is it something in the Mexican soul? Mexicans have different souls than we do. There's a special heaven where Mexicans go, more brightly decorated, more highly spiced, and much cheaper than ours. But be careful of the milk and honey. You're safer with the bottled water. No, it's just that their country has been run by party hacks for 65 years, and that party is synonymous with the government, and the government is synonymous with the economy, and all life is a patronage plum. If you want to know why it takes so much red tape to accomplish anything in Mexico, and why, after all that red tape, the thing isn't accomplished, and why nobody is surprised when it isn't, think of a 763,000-square-mile, 78-million-employee New York City Department of Motor Vehicles. Of course, Mexico's Federal Electoral Institute has changed all that and brought the country U.S.-type democracy. This is the 1990s, and the Mexican oligarchy knows it just can't steal votes to get elected. It has to lie to voters, too. During one of my many visits to IFE, I watched a 25-minute videotape explaining Mexico's free, fair, and totally honest election system. The background music was a bit too reminiscent of the I Dream of Jeannie theme for something purporting to describe a total lack of trickery, but the video said IFE was trustworthy because every one of its rules, decisions, programs, appointments, committees, employees, and public announcements has to be approved by all 9 of Mexico's political parties. And there are some strange ones, such as the Authentic Mexican Revolutionary Party, led by a retired rancher from Coahuila, notable for having started a campaign against cow ticks, and the party of the Cardenista Front for National Reconstruction, named after the late General Lázaro Cárdenas, father of the Cárdenas running for president of the opposing PRD ticket. The Cardenista Front didn't think Cárdenas was Cardenista enough. According to the video, thousands of citizen poll watchers would be present to monitor the electoral performance. The poll watchers were chosen by lot. They had to be registered voters who were under 70, were able to read and write, and weren't government workers or leading figures in a political party. Which brings us to an interesting question about true democracy. Why not let them run Mexico? And why not let them run the United States? Do you think a randomly chosen, literate American voter who doesn't have Alzheimer's, isn't an IRS employee, and hasn't got an impeached billary sign stuck in his lawn, would be a worse president than Clinton, Bush, Reagan, Carter, Ford? And let us not forget that, if the United States had an election system as free, fair, and totally honest as Mexico's, Nixon would have been president 8 years sooner. On election day, Rolando and I went back up to the Chiapan Highlands. I wanted to see the Indian towns around San Cristobal, towns from which the Zapatistas presumably drew support. We were accompanied by an American anthropologist, whom I'll call Bill, who spent years in the area and had a pretty good idea of what was going on. "Nothing much," said Bill. Which was a problem, because when daring, intrepid foreign correspondents don't find trouble to cover, they risk turning into cloying, pathetic travel writers. The town of Zinacatan is a must-see on any Chiapas vacation jaunt. Though modern amenities are few, the friendly, colorful Tzotzil Indian natives... Stop me before I describe the cathedral. Zinacatan did have an impressive cathedral. Fortunately for readers, this has nothing to do with Mexican election conflicts, and the people of Zinacatan weren't having much to do with those conflicts either. I mean, they were standing in line to vote, but that was it. The men and women were in separate queues. How much did this tell us about Indian society? What political and cultural significance did it have? Why were they lined up this way? "They felt like it," said Bill. I tried interviewing again. Here is the most partisan response I got. "Whoever wins, good luck." Then a busload of French tourists arrived. They'd come to see the cathedral. Who did they support? They conferred among themselves. Probably the socialist PRD, they agreed. "But," I said, "I thought the socialists were unpopular in France right now." "Oh, we don't want the socialists in our country," said the tour leader. I asked Bill, "Who are the Zinacatans really for? The Zapatistas, maybe?"
"I can't imagine the Zinacatans being for anybody," he said. "They're pretty independent."
And he told me that during the Gulf War, they had invoked their most powerful supernatural protector, the butterfly spirit, to keep them out of the conflict. There are 7 sacred peaks in the mountain rim around Zinacatan, and the shamans went from one to another holding a ceremony that had not been performed in living memory. "Why were they so concerned about the Gulf War?" I asked.
"Because it was about oil," said Bill. "The way they saw it, Kuwait has oil, and Mexico has oil, and you never know."
If you think about it, their reasoning was very similar to the Bush administration's. We visited a couple of other towns, Larenzar and Chamula. Nothing happened there, either. I did see lewd graffiti.
Someone had spelled out the Zatzal word miss in the dust on the fender of a tourist car. Miss means kitty or pussy. In Zatzal, as in English, it's slang for the female genitals.
The Mayans love a pun, said Bill. Mayan kids are tickled by the idea that unmarried American women are called miss, and think nothing is funnier than to run down the street calling out to tourist ladies, Miss! Oh, miss! Hello, miss!
Bill felt that the national elections didn't impress the Zatzal Mayans. They have their own way of making decisions, he said. Apparently, everyone in a community gets together, and they talk for days until complete consensus on a given issue is reached. Bill saw much to be admired in this. I thought it sounded even worse than regular politics. Bill admitted it had its shortcomings as a goal-oriented policy tool. He told me about a village up in the mountains so poor that the Indians used to say, All we have are rocks. Then a corporation from Mexico City came and said the rocks could be turned into agricultural lime. The corporation offered to pay the village a very large sum. The Indians got together and yakked and yakked. After weeks of deliberation, they announced they were refusing the corporation's offer.
All we have are rocks, they said. And if we sell those, we won't have anything.
We drove into San Cristobal late in the afternoon. The Zapatistas had not disturbed the election day peace, although this was not literally true because a young man was selling Zapatista folk music cassettes on the street and using a boombox to play sample cuts. Marcos's song, the Zapatistas' hymn, Ballad of Emiliano Zapata. Think of several tenor Leonard Cohen singing off-key with a mariachi band accompanied by your summer camp counselor on acoustic guitar. I hadn't taken the Zapatista invasion of San Cristobal very seriously, but now, remembering that the rebels had held the radio station for a whole day, my heart went out to listeners everywhere in the broadcast area. Rolando, Bill, and I were walking down the street, clutching souvenir Zapatista cassettes, when an American woman ran up. She was fully my age, but dressed like a runaway teen and wearing a pair of the biggest, blackest possible shoes. She was out of breath and nearly ecstatic with indignation.
I'm so glad the media is here, she said. The government is cheating on the ballots. There's trouble at the voting booths. There may be...
Her voice was filled with hope.
A riot!
She pulled a small tape recorder from her purse and held it in the air, ready to make a permanent record of the cataclysmic events soon to transpire. We went over to the central plaza, where about 1,000 voters were standing in line. Some of them had been there since early morning, and now it seemed as though there weren't going to be enough ballots for them all. They were irked. This was a special polling place, where people who weren't registered in San Cristobal could place absentee votes. But because San Cristobal was a left-wing attraction at the moment, and a tourist resort besides, an extra number of out-of-towners were on hand. Sure enough, the polling place ran out of voting slips. Then the people in line got very irked, and pushed up onto the bandstand where the voting tables were, and trapped a couple of IFE officials. One of those Frank Capra-type voices from the crowd rang out with stern reasonableness,
We demand an explanation!
A chant began.
We want to vote!
An awning over the voting table was torn down. A couple of loudmouths on the steps of the bandstand called for the ballots to be burned, which seemed beside the point since the problem was that there weren't any ballots. An enthusiastically outraged young Mexican journalist asked me,
Where are you from?
Rolling Stone, I replied.
Right on,
he said, fabulously out of date. Someone jumped on a chair and shouted that he had a plan. He said that anybody who didn't get the vote should write down his or her name and address, and then they'd send a petition of grievance to Mexico City. This didn't sound like much fun. The fellow on the chair was booed. It's almost an ugly crowd, I said to another American reporter, who was pressed against the bandstand railing next to me. This crowd is exactly as angry, said my compatriot, as the crowd at O'Hare Airport on a holiday weekend when the flight to LaGuardia had been canceled. If they get somebody up there announcing free frequent flyer miles, and that's practically what happened. The head of the Federal Electoral Institute in San Cristobal elbowed his way to the voting table and began an allowed reading from IFE rules and regulations.
It seems that Article Jillion, Section Zillion, states that special polling places for absentee voters shall be supplied with only so-and-so many ballots, and when those ballots are exhausted, no more shall be given out, etc. A strange-looking man with a guitar and Zapatista stickers all over his sombrero tried to drown out the IFE official with one of those folk songs, but the crowd shushed him. When the man from IFE was finished reading, there was a shuffling in the plaza, and murmurs, and ums, and humphs.
"Marcos!" yelled somebody.
"Revolution!"
yelled somebody else. I looked out at the throng. All the Mexicans were laughing, but scattered among the Indian and mestizo faces were the pallid mugs of gringo hippies, their mouths still frowning at injustice, and eyes still bright with the dream that this might be Columbia University, 1968, all over again. I arrived back in Tuzla too late to catch the 10 minutes of election night anti-PRI window busting which went on downtown. Some of the same happened in the national capital and a few other places. Then it petered out. Mexico may be a time bomb, but it's also Mexico. Plenty of fuse, and somebody forgot the explosives. By American standards, there wasn't much election coverage on TV. Every now and then, a special bulletin would interrupt the regular programming, Prom Night 3, dubbed in Spanish. Sometime after midnight, the pan-presidential candidate gave a concession speech so long it would have taken him less time to serve a term as president. The next morning, Rolando and I were supposed to interview representatives from the three major political parties, listen to them as they poor-mouthed, mealy-mouthed, or big-mouthed. But nobody's ever on time in Mexico, me and Rolando included. By 2 p.m, the only person we'd talked to was a local PAN organizer, a personable young OBGYN. And, to tell the truth, I wasn't really paying attention to him until he'd walked us out the door of his modest office and was standing next to a VW Bug decorated with National Action Party bumper stickers. Then the doctor mentioned, with amused resignation, that in Mexico the big houses and big cars belonged to people who got into politics, not medical school. From 2 to 5, Tuzla shuts down for midday meal and siesta. Rolando invited me to his house, a pleasant bungalow on a hill overlooking the city. A dozen people were there, cousins, in-laws, friends, kids, his mom. Rolando's wife had cooked 3 huge platters of roast pork on banana leaves, which she served with rice, guacamole, hot peppers, steamed onions, and fresh-baked flour tortillas. We drank a case of beer, and then a bottle and half of brandy. Rolando and I were the only English speakers, though thanks to liquid Berlitz, we were all eloquent. But not a word was said about politics, and no one in Rolando's house was wearing big black shoes. Indeed, the women wore high heels and jewelry in the middle of the day. This is a civilized country. Rolando got out his guitar and played the sentimental, heartbroken songs beloved by Mexicans, such as Margaritaville. Lunch lasted 6 hours. I never did interview anybody from other political parties, and who cares? Let us ponder a few questions about things political. When a reward or distinction goes to someone who doesn't deserve it, why do we say it was politics? When we call a person a real politician, is it a compliment? Are the words office politics ever used to describe anything good that happened at work? How often do we have the occasion to call someone an ethical hack, or spiritual hack, or a philosophical hack? And what does the term political appointee bring to mind? Do you suppose Surgeon General Jocelyn Elders is much of a surgeon? Would you let her perform your vasectomy? Mexicans had an election. Nothing happened. God bless them. Mexicans know that the world doesn't need more politics. It needs more lunch. The 1987 stock market crash. The American Spectator. On Monday, October 19 of this year, the stock market went to the bathroom. Since then, a lot of us have been pretty busy, talking our broker pals down from window ledges, and convincing friends in the junk bond business to shut off the Porsche and open the garage door. We've been so busy that we may not have noticed Black and Blue Monday marked the end of an era. Neo-poverty means curtains for the yuppies, a.k.a. the me generation, a.k.a. the now generation, a.k.a. the Dr. Spock brats. Everybody born between World War II and the early 60s is finally going to have to grow up.
It's all over now, baby boom. Of course, the collapse of the Reagan pig-out wasn't the only thing that did us boomers in. There was massive drug-taking, which turned out to be a bad idea. Maybe drugs make you a better person, but only if you believe in heaven and think John Belushi could get past the doorman. And having sex with everyone we could think of, this broke up our first two marriages and gave most of us chronic venereal diseases and the rest of us obituaries. And then there was us, just being ourselves, finding out who we are, getting in touch with our feelings, fulfilling our true inner potential. Frightening stuff. You'll notice that now we're all running out to rent the Fatal Attraction video so we can moon over a nuclear family and cheer for traditional morals. It seems like that boring middle-class suburbia where we grew up was swell after all. The problem is, we've spent all our money on cocaine and Reeboks and we can't afford it. What went wrong? We were the generation of hope, the generation that was going to change the world, the biggest, richest, best-educated generation in the history of America, the biggest, richest, best-educated spot in this or any other galaxy. Nothing was too good for us. It took thousands of doctors and psychiatrists to decide whether we should suck our thumbs or all our toes, too. Our every childhood fad had global implications. One smile at Davy Crockett in the forest of the Temperate Zone were leveled in the search for raccoon tail hats. When we took up hula hoops, the planet bobbled in its orbit. Our transistor radios drowned out the music of the spheres. A sniffle from us, and Life magazine was sick in bed for a month. All we had to do was hold a sit-in, and governments were toppled from the Beijing of Mao Zedong to the Cleveland of Denis Kukinich, child mayor, elected in 1977 at the age of 30, governed about as well as you'd imagine, now deservedly forgotten. "We are the world," we shouted just a couple of years ago, and just a couple of years ago we were. How did we wind up so old, so fat, so confused, so broke? The truth is, our generation was spoiled rotten from the start. We spent the entire 1950s on our butts in front of the television, while Mom fed us Twinkies and Ring-Dings through strawberry-flavor straws, and Dad ransacked the toy stores looking for 100-mile-an-hour streamlined Schwinn's, Daisy air howitzers, Lionel train sets larger than the New York Central system, and other novelties to keep us amused during the few hours when Pinky Lee and my friend Flicka weren't on the air. When we came of age in the 1960s, we found the world wasn't as perfect as Mr. Green Jeans and Ozzie Nelson said it would be, and we threw a decade-long temper tantrum. We screamed at our parents, our teachers, the police, the president, Congress, and the Pentagon. We threatened to hold our breath, as long as the reefer stayed lit, and not cut our hair until poverty, war, and injustice were stopped. That didn't work. So we whiled away the 1970s in an orgy of hedonism and self-absorption, bouncing from ashram to bedroom to disco to gym at a speed made possible only by ingesting vast quantities of Inca scratch and sniff. Even this proved unsatisfying, so we elected President Reagan and tried our hand at naked greed. We could have it all: career, marriage, job, children, BMW, Rolex, compact disc player, another marriage, more children, and a high-growth, high-yield, no-load mutual fund. Actually, for a while, it looked like we could have it all, as long as we didn't mind also having a national debt the size of Crab Nebula, an enormous underclass making its living from 5-cent beverage can deposits, and currency that the Japanese use to blow their noses. But now our economy has the willy-walls, and our youth culture has arthritis, Alzheimer's, and gout. Life's big Visa card bill has come due at last. The baby boom has reached middle age. It's time for us to pause, time to reflect, time to... Oh, God, darling, don't do it with a gun. We just redecorated the bathroom. Time to evaluate the contributions that we as a generation have made to a world which presented us with so many unique advantages. Contributions such as... Time's up. Well, some of the Beatles songs are really great. Although technically the Beatles aren't part of the baby boom. And there's that first Tom Robbins novel, another roadside attraction. That was good, I think. I mean, I was very stoned when I read it, and New Coke? Wait a minute, I hear dissenting noises. Civil rights, you say?
But the civil rights movement was founded by people a lot older than us. Harriet Tubman, for instance. We boomers did start the peace movement. That was a big success. The Vietnam War only lasted another 8 or 10 years, once we got the peace movement going. Then, darn it, the communists took over South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, and killed everybody they could get their hands on, just like General Westmoreland, that pig, said they would. So I don't think we can count the peace movement as a major contribution, especially not as far as the former citizens of Phnom Penh are concerned. Our political commitment, however, really changed things. You can tell by the quality of the presidents that we used to have, such as Truman and Eisenhower, compared with the quality of the presidents that we got as soon as the baby boom was old enough to vote, such as Ford and Carter. And our idealism has made a difference. Ever since Live Aid, all the Ethiopians have had to do the Jane Fonda workout to keep from larding up around the middle. It is true that our generation was the first to take feminism seriously. That's because old-timey feminists used to worry about boring things like voting rights and legal status. But boomer women put some real life in the issue by emphasizing upscale grabbiness, pointless careerism, and insane arguments about pronoun antecedents. Fitness is another trend pioneered by the boom. Millions of us are leading empty, useless, pitiful lives and lifting weights and eating fiber to make those lives last longer. Also, the computer revolution. We invented a brilliant matrix of complex and intricate software programs which allow us to compile, cross-reference, and instantly access all the nothing that we know. Finally, there's our creativity, our wild, innovative, original artistic gifts, surely a legacy to the ages. Huh? Huh? Sorry, I couldn't hear you. I had the new LL Cool J Bigger and Deffer tape turned all the way up on my Walkman. Let's face it. Our much-vaunted rebellion against bourgeois values meant we didn't want to clean the bathroom. All our mystical enlightenments are now printed in Hallmark greeting cards. Our intellectual insights led to a school system that hasn't taught anybody how to read in 15 years. All we've done for the disadvantaged is gentrify the crap out of their neighborhoods. And now we're about to lose our jobs. Do we have any skills or anything? No. Complain, play Donkey Kong, and roll joints with easy wider papers are the only things this generation has ever been able to do. Will anyone feel sorry for us? No. We've been making pests of ourselves for 4 decades, hogging the limelight, making everybody feel unhip and out of it. The earth has had a belly full of us. We'll be selling kiwi fruit on the street and rattling microchips in a tin cup, and people will laugh. We're a generation whose heroes were Howdy Doody, Jerry Rubin, Big Bird, and Ivan Boesky. We deserve the stock market crash, and herpes, and the Betty Ford Clinic besides. We're jerks. We're clowns. We're 40 and still wearing jeans. Nobody takes us seriously. Wait a minute. Serious. That's it. Oh, man, this will really bug the squares. What we do is we all start wearing dumpy corduroy sports coats and cheap, shiny, navy blue wash pants and hush puppies. We get those stupid half-glasses and wear them way down on the ends of our noses. We read Schopenhauer, Wittgenstein, Kant, all those guys. We call it the new seriousness. The media will wig out. We'll be all over network TV again. Dig this. We start going to church. Not Mooney Church or Born Again Church, but real Episcopalian church every Sunday. We invite each other over to afternoon teas and discuss the novels of Thomas Mann. We take up the cello. We do the London Times crossword puzzle in ink. We admire Woody Allen's recent movies. We vote in local elections. We'll be crazy serious, international superstars of, like, heavy, pensive egg-headery. We fire David Letterman and replace him with Jean-Paul Sartre. Is he still alive? Well, somebody like that. Shoot MTV videos for Handel and Rimsky-Korsakov. Do a feature movie about the life of Euripides with the soundtrack in ancient Greek. There are 76 million of us. Everybody's going to want a Books on Tape cassette of Bertrand Russell and Anne Whitehead's Principia Mathematica for their car. We'll make a fortune, we'll be famous, and we'll change the world. The new seriousness. It's bitchin', it's far out, it's rad to the max, it's us. Gotta go now. Gotta call Merrill Lynch and buy stock in the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra. Whitewater, Rolling Stone, 1994. This is twice in 2 years I've wound up on a fool's errand in Little Rock. The last time I was supposed to be delivering a big wet kiss of national approval to the Democratic presidential candidate. This time I'm expected to give the same guy a popularly mandated smackaroo of political death. Will you, the public, please make up your mind? Do you want Bill Clinton covered in regular flowers or the Jennifer kind? You're always mad at us journalists. Back in early 92, you said we were being too hard on the boy when we needled him for sleeping through Vietnam, pointed out that he didn't know how to smoke marijuana right, and dredged up some tomato he hadn't canoodled with for months and months. Then Clinton got the Democratic nomination. We members of the press clapped our hands raw at his speech about how he had a childhood like a whole week of Oprah Winfrey shows. We patted his back until his suit jacket shoulder pads popped for picking Al Gore to hand out mints after state dinners. And you said we were being too kind. You said we ignored Clinton's history of double-shuffling the issues and playing olly-olly out and free with the truth. You claimed we didn't tell you his staff still wore diapers. We cuddle-bunnied him right into office. Every time Bill Clinton sits down, the Washington Post gets a broken nose, you said. Now we're all in Little Rock vowing we've got enough dirt to keep network camera crews riding John Deere's until Colin Powell runs for office. Our rakes drip muck, our slings groan with mud, and we've got a giant clothes hamper choked with soiled First Family business apparel. Phew! Cattle market socks. We're hearing an ominous noise of rattling femurs among the White House coat hangers, and you're still not happy. You say we're distracting Clinton from the business of government. Well, I hope so. Distracting a politician from governing is like distracting a bear from eating your baby. Or like getting a dog to quit chewing on your wallet, anyway. But what do you want us to do? Come on, you're the customer. You tell us. Should we go back to Washington and write 100-column-inch, cerebrum-snuffing, eyeball-fibrillating articles on health care reform? How about some NAFTA follow-ups? A 9-part series on the Republic of Kyrgyzstan? Or maybe we should come over to your house and investigate you. So leave us alone. Sure, we're down here hunting the president in a pack. But that's because we journalists are social animals. We're just having fun. Actually, nobody but other journalists will have anything to do with us. You want us to mate and breed, don't you? Besides, Bill Clinton can take care of himself. Witness his Whitewater press conference. He is good. He managed to work his dead mother into the first paragraph of his speech. Note the way Bill's accent goes all country when he's in trouble, though Hot Springs is a boutique resort town and as down home as Martha Stewart. Bill's stepfather was the local Buick dealer. When Clinton talks about an outdoor toilet, he means he was peeing in the swimming pool, somebody in Hot Springs said to me. But Bill's a big, good-looking, lovable goof. I forgot I bought my mother a house. You can't help liking him, and he keeps just a hint of a smirk on his mug to let us know he's not a complete cement head. By the standards of Arkansas, I was honest compared to Richard Nixon. It's pretty much what Bill argued at the press conference, and he carried it off. Bill almost had me convinced Republicans caused Whitewater, until I remembered that Arkansas only has about one Republican, and he had to stay home that week because his wife accidentally used the sheet with the eye holes in it to make the bed. I swear I'm going to get to hell and find Bill has talked his way out. Mullock, I'll say. Did you have a president down here? Kind of a large one, Democrat, of course, with lots of hair, who sounded like Clint Black on cold medication? And Mullock will say, well, he was here, but he got talking to the boss and... Wait a minute, where's my car? Maybe I don't have a lot of sympathy for Bill Clinton, but since coming to Little Rock, I do have sympathy for his waistline, which mine now exactly resembles. Not only is Bill honest by the standards of Arkansas, he's skinny by the standards of Arkansas, too. On my first night in town, I went to a restaurant called Cock of the Walk, where they had deep-fat-fried catfish and deep-fat-fried every other thing you could think of on Earth, including, seriously, deep-fat-fried pickles. They're delicious. So is all the other food in Little Rock. The booze isn't bad either. Arkansas is a state where people still drink, smoke, and eat deep-fat-fried pickles. There are worse places that journalists could be stuck for the next quite a while. We don't want to drive the president out of office until we know for sure whether Al Gore is an alien cyborg. Sure, he looked human when he debated Perot, but I understand it blew out 2/3 of his circuits. Since then, you'll notice, the administration hasn't let Gore do anything more complicated than interface with a tornado warning system in Georgia. Anyway, the media horde is in Little Rock. We go to Doe's to get steaks as